With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom, reach new audiences, and bring important information to the public, free of charge. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom, and donate today. Visit realitycheck.radio/donate.
Wednesday morning is our morning for Legal Hub here at RCR. And joining me this morning, Nick Kearney is back. Hi, Nick.
Paul, good to hear you and see you again. It's been a while, but it's great to be back.
It's been quite a few weeks.
Great to be back, yeah.
Yeah, nice to have you back too. And a special guest on our Legal Hub this morning is Gary Judd KC. Gary, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
All right, before we start talking, I want to kind of set the table. Have you heard of Kylie Quince? Kylie Quince, Associate Professor, is the Dean of the School of Law at the University of Auckland faculty. And she made the following online comments to our guest on Legal Hub this morning, Gary Judd KC, after he lodged a complaint with the Government Regulations Review Committee regarding mandatory tikanga Māori studies for law students. And I quote, "I suppose it was inevitable that one of the old racist dinosaurs would make a pathetic squeal in an attempt to preserve the status quo. Mr. Judd and his Matarangi Māori is not science friends can go die quietly in the corner." Gary's response, a law school to be avoided, Auckland University of Technology. In it, he asks, "What sort of lawyers will be produced by a law faculty led by someone who resorts to petty abuse instead of engaging in rational argument? Why did she not explain why tikanga is law? Why did she not explain why a body of law built up over centuries for the purpose of testing whether a custom should be accorded the status of law must be jettisoned because tikanga cannot meet those standards? Why did she not answer other matters raised in my complaint to the Regulations Review Committee? Responses like those could have been expected from a person holding a privileged leadership position. As it is not the response given, the inference may be drawn that she does not have answers which support her position." Winston Peters tweeted in support of Judd, saying, "Tikanga is not law, it is cultural indoctrination." Peter said it highlighted the utter depths of absurdity this woke cultural madness has taken our society. "The tikanga regulations will compel law students to be taught that a system which does not conform with the rule of law is nevertheless law, which should be observed and applied. As Judd KC points out in his complaint, tikanga is not law. Law students should not be force-fed this kind of woke indoctrination from some cultural warrior's slanted version of what tikanga means. What is most concerning is the Dean of the AUT Law School, Kylie Quince, funded by the taxpayer, decided to typically stoop to a gutter level and call Judd an old racist dinosaur who should die quietly in the corner. This is from someone who is in charge of teaching our law students. How has this kind of insipid, cancerous, woke indoctrination taken a hold within our education system? Judd KC pointed out what is written in law and the ridiculous compulsion to indoctrinate students with irrelevant cultural interpretations, having no reason being part of a law degree. Someone in Quince's position with this septic and out-of-touch modus operandi raises the question of the proper use of taxpayer funding. She does not represent New Zealand or what we expect in our tertiary institutions." Unquote, from Winston Peters tweeting in support of Gary Judd. So from Bassett, Brash and Hyde, where I'm reading this headline from, the Gary Judd piece I just told you about, a law school to be avoided, Auckland University of Technology. A law school to be avoided, Gary.
Yes, well, the background of that is that I have lodged a complaint with Parliament's Regulation Review Committee, in which I have asked them to resolve, or to ask the House of Representatives to resolve, to disallow what I call the tikanga regulations promulgated by the New Zealand Council for Legal Education. And I provided a copy of my complaint to the Law Association's Law News publication, and they published an edited version of it. And it would appear that Kylie Quince, when she saw it, decided that the best way to respond was in the way in which she did, which you've just referred to.
Yeah.
So that's the background.
She said some pretty strong stuff, actually.
Well, one would have expected the dean of a law school to actually respond to a lengthy reasoned piece with reasoned argument as to why I'm wrong in making my complaint, or why my complaint is wrong, rather than simply engaging in vulgar abuse. The point that I was really making in the article, which you tell me is now Bassett, yeah, Hyde and Brash have now published, the point that I was making is that if that is the calibre of the person who is leading the law school at AUT, then really it is a law school to be avoided, because the students are not really going to be getting the sort of education and law that they should get if that's the person who's leading them.
How does someone like get a job like that?
I have no idea. You would have to ask. Presumably, the vice chancellor of AUT or somebody. I have no knowledge of how this might happen.
Nick, what do you make of that?
Make of what, how she might have been appointed as a dean?
Well, no, two things. Just the response, that like a landmine, you're treading on a landmine, and then how she got there.
Yeah. Look, everybody, not everybody, but most people in life, maybe Gary excused, maybe you too excused Paul, but a lot of people in life have made silly comments and on social media, right? It's a very intemperate kind of domain where, you know, tempers can flare, and you can, you know, keyboard warriors can just sit there and bash away and say something and then go, oh, actually that probably wasn't very wise. So to some extent you can look at Kylie, she is a staunch advocate for her cause and her beliefs, etc, obviously, and just reacted to what Gary had done with his complaint like that. But that is the reaction of a 17-year-old keyboard warrior, a Karen from Facebook, if you like, rather than a dean of a law school in the biggest city in the country. And she needed to have sat back. It's not difficult to type something in and then look at it and go, actually, I probably shouldn't push submit or send here.
Yeah.
Right. But she didn't do that. She did send it and submitted it. And
but you take on a job like that in the knowledge that this is part of your responsibility, very strict responsibility, is not to behave in this way because of what people will say.
And Gary is right. And one of the problems with this whole debate around tikanga or tikanga and related stuff is that the people on that side of the debate, led by people like Kylie and others, most of them, you know, are quite activist and angry type activist type people, and they don't like, I think that's probably the way to put it, but they don't tend to want or prefer or like reasoned debate, as Gary said, and he's correct. They resort to intemperate kind of comments, anger, abuse, Ms. Quince's comments were spot on from the point of view that, you know, what did she say, Gary, racist old dinosaur or something, and he could go die. That's kind of, you know, where they come from in these arguments, because I don't know why, and I say because, actually I don't know why, so I shouldn't probably use the word because, but yeah. It's more than that. It carried on as well, and we have a publication in the law fraternity in Auckland called Law News. And Law News goes to 5,600 lawyers every week in Auckland. The editor of Law News is Jenny McManus, who used to be MBR. She's no fool. She's a good editor. Gary published his complaint in Law News about the same week or week after, and she ran it essentially word for word. It might have even been an opinion piece from Gary on his complaint. A week following that, a retired ex District Court Judge David Harvey, who is very strong on freedom of speech and very good in that area, written books on it, as I understand, and very good on internet law, published an opinion piece in the same publication saying why Gary's article was important and should be aired, because it's simply freedom of speech. Because after Gary's article had been published, you got, you know, a few angry responses from the Kylie Quinces of this world. And David, you know, David didn't, Judge Harvey, I suppose we can call him, but he didn't necessarily support Gary saying. All that Judge Harvey was saying was, Gary has a right to say this, and it's a very important debate, and we shouldn't be opposing the debate and trying to shut it down with abuse and threats of that nature. Now, Jenny McManus got into trouble, if you can put it that way, again on social media, on LinkedIn, and she was accused of publishing two articles, one from Gary and one then from Judge Harvey, without giving any of the other side a right of reply. And this went on LinkedIn for quite a while on a page, and a whole bunch of lawyers jumped in. And, you know, even they were having a go at Jenny, calling her a far-right MBR former editor, and she's in Gary, blah, blah, blah. Now, Jenny quite properly responded saying, well, hang on a sec. I did receive a reply, but not before the editorial deadline. And I have reached out to the a couple of prominent organisations on the other side of the debate to publish their response next week. So you guys just offer me an apology and back off. But of course, you never got it. And of course, this week in the law news, there were two alternative responses on why tikanga should be taught, what it's all about, and why it's important, blah, as, you know, Judge Harvey would want them to be aired. So, but the problem we faced in the interim was the anger and intemperate type, you know, behaviour on social media, and particularly some, you know, vile words directed at the likes of Gary and others who went to defend him.
I want to get on to the complaint in just a moment, Gary, but this is what's the kind of slant or skew that's being taught in the institution, is it? Does she reflect that? Because that's a worry. Simple guy on the street asking here.
Well, yes, well, I think it is actually. Since my complaint was published in Law News, I have had a few people who have been in touch with me. Some existing students and some student or people who were students not quite recently. And they have explained to me that this is actually already happening in the law school. For example, one student from Waikato University has told me that they are being taught that there are three laws in New Zealand. First of all, there is tikanga, and then along came Pākehā law. And the student told me that when this was said by the lecturer, it was said with sort of dripping sarcasm. And then now the students were told we are actually in the course of replacing Pākehā law with tikanga.
Oh, what?
So that, according to her, is what is being taught at the moment at Waikato University. Now, judging by Kylie Quince's behaviour, I imagine probably the same sort of thing is happening at AUT. In fact, I think one of the people who corresponded with me was somebody who had started his law degree under Charles Rickett, who was the previous dean, and everything was going along quite swimmingly. And then Charles retired and Kylie Quince got appointed. And since then, the teaching has gone downhill rapidly. And he told me that he finished his degree as quickly as he could and got out of the place. So, you know, this at the moment, it would appear that this sort of thing, despite the compulsory aspect of it not coming into effect until the 1st of January next year, nevertheless, the law schools are, or at least some of them, well into the idea of propagating tikanga as if it were law. And my fundamental objection to this is that tikanga is not law. Tikanga is a mystical approach. It's best described as a religion. It is said that by the learned people who provided information to the Supreme Court, that it is something which grows out of the land and came to New Zealand with the first of the canoes, and that in some traditions it was already here. In other words, on the basis that there was nobody in New Zealand before the Maori first arrived, tikanga was nevertheless already here, oozing out in some way from the ground.
Okay.
And my point is, whatever that may be, a religious type set of beliefs, which Maori, or at least some Maori, subscribe to, but it's not law. And I object to the idea that the study of what is in effect a religion should be made compulsory for law students. That, in fact, is the guts of my complaint.
You actually might not be surprised to hear you don't get any argument from me on what Gary's just said. I completely concur. It's not law, except that those on the opposing view would say, well, hang on a sec, it's not law as you know it. Gary and Nick, it's not law as you know it, and as you have grown up to know what law is through your 50-odd years, sure, I accept that, but it's our law, and it's what we have understood forever and ever, amen, since at least before, the Whiteys came here in 1840. It's law that we can understand. You might not be able to understand it, but after we teach it to you, you'll understand what it's all about. But it's not law as we know it, and as has been gone through the common law English legal system of hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. It is, in fact, a tribal system based on customs and beliefs. That's all it is. And you cannot have, in a functioning Westminster democracy common law legal system like we have, a tribal legal system or tribal system of customs and beliefs that varies from iwi to iwi and hapu to hapu. And one of the aspects of law is that law must be certain so that everybody knows how to behave under it in a social context. And with tikanga, it is not certain because it varies from the top of the North Island to the bottom of the South Island according to which way the wind blows any particular day. And that's not just me saying that. That is the experts who said it in the Alice decision in the Supreme Court, who were asked to advise the court on what tikanga actually is from a Maori context. And I've read that decision. So I remember, Paul, I went on about this here many months ago when it came out. And the experts said that, and they listed a whole bunch of principles, kaitiakitanga and other guardianship ones. I potentially, as I say to my friends, look, guardianship or kaitiakitanga and the others, like what Ngāi Tahu considers that is different than what Ngāti Tuwharetoa or Tainui think is guardianship. It's all different from iwi to iwi. And one of the other things I say about tikanga principles is this, is that, and think about this for a minute from a legal position, I don't know how it would work, one of the principles, as we know, in tikanga or Maori customary tribal system is the concept of utu, or revenge, right? Yep. So what's to stop somebody from beating the crap out of someone else for revenge, turning up to court and saying, utu, it's tikanga, it's allowed, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Now, the court at the time could say, don't be silly, we're not going to allow utu as tikanga, but we might allow something else as tikanga, the one that, Mr. Alice sort of was able to have his mana restored when his conviction was overturned or something like that. But then you might find in a different iwi setting or hapu setting, a different part of the country, that utu is acceptable. and a judge in that court might say, I've had the experts from this hapu and iwi turn up and say that utu's fine down here, I'm going to accept it as a justification or excuse. So this is the problem with it, that it, you know, and what one of the other arguments, you know, that is made and Gary makes and others like Stephen Franks, and even the New Zealand Initiative guy, Roger Partridge, is that it's fundamentally in breach of the rule of law as we know it in New Zealand. It just cannot exist, in my view, side by side with our common law legal system. It can't. And, I mean, there's a just look, and Gary will appreciate this, and for the people who are listening who may know a little bit about law, you know, at law school you are taught in terms of the tort of negligence. You are taught that negligence has a few common factors. There has to be a duty. There has to be a breach of that duty to somebody. That breach has to be foreseeable. The loss has to be foreseeable, not too remote. So duty, breach. A breach causes damage. The damage has to be foreseeable, not too remote. And then there has to be public policy considerations as to whether a duty should be applied in that particular situation. That's how the law of negligence has developed over 200 years from Donoghue and Stevenson. There is no way that you can develop a system of takanga along those lines. It would just be too uncertain and too impossible. So I just don't know how it can work. And I've actually been, I read the two articles in Law News from Barrister Kingi Snelgo and the other person during the week, and I was looking for something erudite and clear around this is what takanga is and this is how it can work in New Zealand. I'm yet to find it. I'm yet to read it. And if someone could actually, I know there's a Law Commission report on it. Maybe I'll find time to read that. But I have great difficulty in trying to figure out how it can work. And therefore, how it can be taught.
Wow. Okay. So how come it's wiring itself in if it's so unworkable? I don't get it. Gary?
Well, I'm a lawyer, not a psychologist, so I really can't answer that question.
Well, you've got to know why something's happening, right, so you can kind of defend against it.
To my mind, there's no rational basis.
Me neither. And it's actually... There have been some decisions that have referred to it over, since about 1860 or something. There's two or three of them that say that takanga is part of the, New Zealand legal system, common law system or something. It's about all they say, I think.
In fact, they haven't said that. where tikanga has been taken into account is where it has actually been proved as a custom. There are circumstances where customs can be recognised and taken into account in illegal decisions. But there are rules about how that can happen. First of all, the custom has to be certain, it has to be consistent, it has to be reasonable, it has to be in accord with morality. And In the Alice case in the Supreme Court, the judges who were in favour of taking tikanga into account or treating it as something as so-called first law said tikanga cannot meet these standards, therefore we're going to jettison the standards. So, these are no longer part of the law of New Zealand for proving customs because tikanga can't meet them. So one of the points that I've made in relation to this education thing is that law students are being told that something which does not satisfy these obviously sensible requirements for according the status of law to custom are being told that... it nevertheless is law. And so even if something is contrary to morality, it will still must be taken to be amenable to incorporation in the legal system. And then, these students get out into the real world and they start practicing as lawyers and become subject to the fundamental obligation imposed by Section 3 of the Law Practitioners Act saying that their first fundamental obligation is to uphold the rule of law and the administration of justice. Well, in fact, if they uphold tikanga, they can't actually uphold the fundamental obligation which the legislation says they must do.
Correct, yeah. No, I agree with Gary on that. I mean, just going back to your question, you know, Paul, how did it? Well, in this context, it arose in the Alice decision, and we've discussed this when it happened, but just as a reminder for the listeners, it was never argued in Alice for over 20 years of all of his appeals. And the Supreme Court just thought, I think it might have been Justice Williams, I'm not sure, but just thought it was a good idea that, you know, they look at it from the concept of, well, what Peter Alice is asking here posthumously is for his mana to be restored.
I can sort of relate to that, that feeling anyway. I can sort of relate to that.
You know, having your mana restored?
Well, you know, to have a desire for that, whether it's a, you know, comes into a legal thing. But, you know, that's not a crazy, you know, if I, you know, well, hold my hand above this thing and if not, something magical will happen.
And, in fact, you don't have to go to tikanga to find that
Because there
were only two judges, two of the Supreme Court judges in Alice, who actually used tikanga to as a reason for saying that the Alice appeal could continue despite the fact that he had died. The other three, the third Justice Glazebrook, who actually was the one who instigated the consideration of tikanga during an earlier case, she said to the lawyers, "Have you thought about the relevance of tikanga?" And they said no. And she said, "Well," and the other judges agreed with her, "we'll adjourn this hearing or go away from this hearing and have a look at it and come back and tell us whether tikanga is relevant to this case." And so what happened was that the lawyers for Alice, obviously seeing that they're on to a good thing, which is not surprising, that's what we lawyers do, they were all in favour of this. But what is worse, what is the bad thing about it, is that the Crown lawyers jumped on the bandwagon as well. And so they got together with some professors in the Māori Law Society, and they produced this statement of tikanga, and they put it before the court on the basis, or under Section 9 of the Evidence Act, which allows an agreed statement to be put before the court. So this statement of tikanga went before the Supreme Court as an agreed statement. Now, Section 9 of the Evidence Act is in the Evidence Act because the Evidence Act is concerned with facts, and Section 9 is used where the parties agree on the facts. And so one of the very strange things about what happened in the Supreme Court is that, using a mechanism which can only be used for facts, they introduced tikanga, and then somehow or other it was called law. So the whole procedure was entirely illegitimate.
Okay, we have about 10 or just over minutes left, so we want to move through a couple of other things. But so what happens now with your complaint? How long does it take?
I don't know. It seems to have gone into limbo. I believe it has been before the Regulation Review Committee, I'm not even certain about that. The standing orders say that when a complaint is lodged to the Regulation Review Committee, it's to be put before the committee at its next scheduled meeting. And I think we've had at least two and maybe three scheduled meetings now, and I've not heard back as to what's happened to it. I suspect that there may be some disagreement on the committee. The committee members comprise David Parker as the chair and a Labour MP, Jenny Salisa, who, as it happens, is actually the wife of the Vice Chancellor of AUT.
Oh dear. Oh dear.
Yeah. And the other three members of the committee are National Party members, one of whom is James Meagher. Right. He's the only one that I really know anything about, mainly because I listened to his magnificent maiden speech in Parliament. So my guess is that the Labor lot will not be at all interested in doing what I've asked. Who knows what may be the position with the Labor members. So, but I suspect that, as I've heard nothing, they probably can't agree. So,
right, you read that into it. Okay.
And what has happened, Paul, is as a result, the New Zealand Law Society has entered the fray and said that, because they're fully in favour, you know, the Law Society, as an organisation which represents 16,600 lawyers around the country, the NZLS is in favour of compulsory takaka.
Yes, well, the interesting thing about the NZLS is that they, in their, they have the New Zealand Law Society, of course, will never publish anything from me, but they will publish their own views, and they have said that, in fact, the Council for Legal Education has, you know, fully consulted. Well, what actually happened is, well, the Council for Legal Education is a body with about 9 members. There are 2 members who are appointed by the Chief on the recommendation of the Chief Justice, one who's appointed on the recommendation of the Chief District Court Judge. There are 5 who are appointed on the recommendation of the New Zealand Law Society, and there are the Deans of the Law School. I think there are 6 of them. Now, in their annual report, the Council for Legal Education said, we've consulted the judiciary, professional organisations, they don't actually say who they are, and imply that there's been wide consultation. Well, in fact, I don't think there's been any consultation at all, except with those people who are already part of what's been happening. And most importantly, they haven't consulted the lawyers, and the lawyers are levied to fund the Council for Legal Education. So the lawyers are paying, don't even get told what's going on, and asked whether they, you know, whether they agree with it.
Yeah, and I looked at and they referred to a survey done a couple of years ago amongst, I think, students or the somebody else, and, you know, the survey, 70, you know what these things are like, Paul, 75% of all people surveyed were in favour of it. Oh, that's good. Well, and they were all lawyers, all, you know, legal professionals.
Law students, correct.
So I jumped into it. Well, how many were surveyed? About 430 or something, right? 75% of them is about 280 or whatever, right? Yeah. And when you look at the overall number of people that could have been part of that group, it's tens of thousands, literally. So I figured out when I looked at this about a week ago, it's about 0.5% of the entire group.
It's a crock being represented.
Absolute crock. I mean, you know, so to say that there's been consultation and we're all in favour is misinformation, Paul.
Oh, you're not allowed to say that.
Oh, okay.
Okay, now we've got tight time, so I just want to thank you so much for taking us through that, Gary. That was really good. Thank you for that. But please hang there because we've got a couple more stories. I want to start with, because our listeners will be interested in this, they would have read about this yesterday. Liz Gunn assault trial judge finds anti-vaccination campaigner guilty of assault, releases damning judgment. Have you looked at this, Nick?
Just briefly, I haven't done any more than read the newspaper story on it. And there's a concept in law, Paul, that the law doesn't get involved in trivialities or trifling matters, particularly in the criminal law context, you know. And it appears that Liz Gunn simply, well, she argues, just put her hand on someone's arm at the airport, a security officer or somebody, and the victim says, no, she did more than that. She grabbed it and yanked my arm or something. So her lawyer, Liz's lawyer, Matthew Haig, who's done some good work, you know, in the COVID stuff, argued that really one of the arguments was the criminal law should not get involved in this. because it's just a trifling, trivial kind of matter.
Has that feel, got to say, for someone who's completely on the outside, it does feel
well,
small time, you know.
Well, how long did it take? That young boy who punched the old lady in the face at the Albert Park, whatever happened to him? I mean, did he get charged in the end? I can't remember. But
was charged, discharged without conviction.
That's discharged without conviction, yeah.
But name suppression.
The poor old Liz, you know, just grabs a security guard in the heat of a moment where she's trying to get camera shots and interviews and bits and pieces, and the security guard, you can't go through there, love you. No, no, stay away, you can't. That she grabs her arm to sort of walk through to push past or something, and she's charged with assault. You know, and now technically, I suppose, you know, if you look at the definition of assault in the Summary Offences Act or Crimes Act or whatever, it's probably technically an assault, but potentially. But, you know, she argued also, I think, consent as well on the behalf of the victim and argued triviality or trifling, the law shouldn't get involved, the criminal law shouldn't get involved. And that there's a reasonable argument to be made on that, but it looks like the judge has wants to make a bit of a scapegoat of her and has lashed out and convicted her of assault, but has acquitted her on the other two charges of trespass and resisting arrest.
Sounds like a triggered moment from the judge to me.
Well, I don't know, possibly. Just you want to make a statement.
Well, they're influenced by the media, just like everybody else, right?
Yeah, potentially. Yeah.
Okay, 3 years on from COVID lockdown protests, Judge Liz Gaynor of the Country Court slams police for responding with unjustified violence. This out of Victoria, Australia. Want to comment on that?
So this is in Melbourne, and this was a case taken by a couple of men who were attended a COVID lockdown protest in Melbourne in 2021, I think, in May 2021. It's almost 3 years ago to the day, actually. And they were quite violently assaulted and beaten up by the police, along with some other protesters. They have sued the police, and the judge has said that the men's arrests were unlawful. They'd done nothing to warrant the violent response captured on the police's body-worn camera. One of the victims was punched in the face by police, thrown to the ground and pepper sprayed while he was on the ground, with another victim having his arm dislocated in the scuffle with police as he tried to resist arrest. So, in fact, I think I said they were suing police. They weren't. They were in court defending charges of common law assault and assaulting an emergency worker. So it looks like the judge has acquitted them and then made those comments around the police action. So, you know, I mean, this is another example. We've talked about it here on the show in the past. We've got Tudor Cleese cases, obviously, down in Wellington, which are before the courts for the police brutality down at the Wellington protest as well. So some of the stuff now is starting to unravel. It's unraveling, I guess, at kind of at a great pace. And anybody who saw, I think, you know, a fair-minded person that saw some of the reaction of the police on the TV in Melbourne, other parts of the world, and then even in Wellington, you don't even have to be kind of take either side. You only have to be a fair-minded person and just look at it and say it was completely out of proportion, in my view.
Yeah, I said country court, county court. So that's quite a low court, is it?
Yeah, county court in Melbourne, a very low court. Probably similar to like a district court here in Auckland, I presume. So not a high level court, but nevertheless a court. And you know, let's just see if these matters are appealed and they go higher. But nevertheless a court, and it's good to see a judge at least standing up and making statements like that.
And finally, Students for Climate Solutions Incorporated versus Minister of Energy and Resources. What's that about?
Well, this caught my attention because I noticed it was a Court of Appeal decision, and there's an organisation, as you said, the Students for Climate Solutions Incorporated, and they're probably, you know, one of these angry mobs who are part of Extinction Rebellion or something, but they took an appeal to the Court of Appeal, arguing over some energy companies' permits for exploration, and arguing that, you know, that it's going to cause climate change or something, we're going to die, so these permits should never have been granted and what have you. And the respondents to the appeal were the energy companies themselves, and the government department, which, you know, had to grant the permit or the consent for the exploration. This is Court of Appeal, and this is an incorporated society. So when I saw that, I've had some instances of this on the North Shore some years ago, where an incorporated society was set up to oppose a property development on the North Shore. And an incorporated society is simply a loose group of people that just come together. You need 15 to form one, I think. You register with the incorporated societies. You don't really need to have, well, in a couple of years' time, there's a lot more requirements about what you need. But at that time, you could form one very, very easily. You don't necessarily have to have any assets or anything like that. So on the North Shore, what happened was, and the members of an incorporated society are not personally liable for the society's debts or liabilities, right? Or the officers, at least. Otherwise, you know, you'd never get people wanting to join it. What here happened on the North Shore was that this incorporated society was formed solely to appeal this resource consent decision for this development in Devonport. And of course, Devonport's a very precious part of North Shore. And they lost, and they were awarded costs, and they said, we haven't got any money.
Thank you.
And so, the council's costs for going to the High Court, the developer's costs for going to the High Court were never met by the losing party, the incorporated society, which is usually the case, or at least part of them are. So when I saw this here, I thought, I just wonder whether a cost award was made against the incorporated society here, considering you've got energy companies, government departments, Court of Appeal, and that was a reasonably significant judgment. It was about, 34 pages, so a decent decision in it. So, but two aspects out of it. One, no costs were awarded against these young student activists, which, are they getting preferential treatment, I suppose. But the second aspect of it, there was a comment made in the judgment, and I'm just trying to find it now. You might refer to it earlier, Paul, I think, but a comment made by the Court of Appeal along the lines that it is without question that climate change is basically a major threat to the world, and it doesn't have to be argued in this court that it is, sort of thing. Now, we've got another lawyer sitting, a KC, Gary Judd, and there's a concept, in law called judicial notice. You can turn up to a court and not have to prove a fact because it's so obvious that the court should just take attention to it. The sky is blue, or it's raining tomorrow. If it's raining, if you turn up and say, it's raining, Your Honour, I don't have to prove it. Look outside. The court can take judicial notice of the fact that it's raining without having to prove it. Well, here we've had essentially a comment in the Court of Appeal by the Court of Appeal judges where they take judicial notice of the fact that climate change is an existential threat and we all need to be aware of it. So that's just an interesting little comment I saw there that, these things, judges can make these little comments in decisions like this, and then, as Gary will know, lawyers pick up and run with them, and God knows where it ends up leading, as we've seen with the Tikanga Alice appeal.
Okay, I've got to leave it there. Thank you so much, Gary Judd KC, for sitting it out there at the end, but for joining us on our Legal Hub program, Gary. We appreciate that. Thank you for coming along.
Yeah.
And Nick Kearney. Nick, thank you for being back on Legal Hub again. We'll do it all again next week.
Good to see you again. Thank you, Gary, very much. Much appreciated. Keep up the good work, Gary.
With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom by simply visiting www.realitycheck.radio/donate to make a difference today.